our two later afternoon talks, and I would like to introduce you to you Kay Welling, who's from our Health Promotion Sciences Unit. Kay is the responsible, she co-authored the book Sexual Behaviour in Britain, which is one of the largest studies carried out on sexual behaviour, and I think that's what she's going to talk to you about this afternoon. Kay.
Thank you very much. Can you all hear me? And good afternoon, everyone, and welcome back after your tea break. The title of my talk, as you can see, is Teenagers and Sex, which tends to put people into a panic. The thought of these two things being in the same sentence tends to put people into a panic. So what I'm going to try to do this afternoon is to have a little look at some of that, the thought of that panic, and also try to quell that panic by looking at the hard information that we've got on young people and sexual behaviour. People do tend to get worried about teenage sexuality, and it's not surprising, really. Sex is a very positive force. It's a way of expressing affection, and it bonds people together, but it's also a very powerful force. It can bring down kings and princesses and soap stars and Tory ministers, and if you've read your papers this morning, you'll see that it can bring down deputy governors of the Bank of England. So it's a very powerful force. And because it's such a strong force, it tends to be managed and controlled in most societies. Most societies have to try to provide a place and a time, especially for it. And it tends not to be during those periods when we're getting on with the important things of life, like work and managing our affairs and so on. Most societies, however primitive, have a social institution in which sex gets looked after. And in ours, it's called marriage. Sex produces children who are best looked after in a stable union, and the institution of marriage makes sure that that happens. It's increasingly less likely for everyone to be married in a society, particularly in Western societies, but generally people, when they have children, live together in a stable union. That's still more the pattern than the exception to the rule. Now the problem is that the age at which society thinks is appropriate for us to enter into this institution of marriage or for us to settle down is a good deal later than the age at which we become ready for sex. In Britain, I'm just going to press this button to see if I get the first slide. I need a bit more light. I'll just show you a couple of slides that show you some of that panic that I was talking about. A couple of newspapers. Let's End This Epidemic of Childhood Sex. That's a newspaper copy. Sex in the Single Londoner. Kids Who Flout the Law. And here this is a reference to the age of sexual consent, which is 16. But as you may or may not know, it is an offence for boys to have sex with a girl under that age, but it's not an offence for the girl. So the girl is protected by the law. Women marry at around 24, 25, and for men the marrying age is a couple of years later. The age at which we are ready for to have a sexual relationship in terms of our biological functions, in terms of our sexual maturity, is much earlier. There's been a falling generally in the age of first menstruation. Sorry, I wanted one before that. The age at which most people, most young women, menstruate is around 13. But it's been falling generally in the West, partly because of improved nutrition. So that means that if most young women are getting married at around 25, but they're sexually mature at the age of 13, then they've got over a decade in which they could theoretically be sexually active and capable, of course, of having children during that time. And that this is going to be reflected in a number of sexual relationships which are possible during that time. And this period, this decade between our physical maturity and the time when we can marry is crucial to our preparation for life. It's the time when you're preparing to enter society as a productive person. You take exams to get into university, you take apprenticeship schemes, you enter training, and so on, to make sure that you become a productive person in society. And so you begin to get an idea of why early sexual activity produces feelings of panickiness. Parents and teachers and people in the church and other concerned adults all worry. They worry that if you're in the throes of a sexual relationship which is very powerful, that you won't get your work done, that you'll lose your sense of ambition, that you won't pass your exams, and so on. I'm sure you know very well what I'm talking about. But I'm also aware as a parent that sometimes children just can't win. I have one boy who was precocious and spent all his time going out with girls, and I worried about him. And I have another boy who stays in all the time and doesn't go out with girls, and I worry about him too. So generally, the world is a fairly panicky place. And yet, all the time, in the midst of all this anxiety from adults, and as a contrast to it, there's a daily barrage of advice about sex from the media. And I'm sure that if you read women's magazines, if you read girls' magazines, and men's magazines too, that you'll see that there are large numbers of pages of those magazines which are devoted to sex, to improving sex, to giving you a more satisfying and more exciting sex life. And so that's not surprising that young people get confused. They are subjected to different advice from different sections of society. Well, one advantage of having conducted a survey, a scientific survey of sexuality, is that we can come up with some fairly hard facts about sex in young people. And we can use those sometimes to quell panic, because sometimes they bear out people's worst fears, but most of the time they tend to be reassuring. When we actually ask people what kinds of sexual behaviour they're involved in at the current time, they tend not to be. They tend not to square with the worst possible scenario. Of course, there are all sorts of... sorry, I do want that one. Thank you. There are all sorts of worries. There are worries that young people are promiscuous. There are other worries that AIDS has put them off sex altogether, as you saw from the last slide. And so the big question is, are young people really more sexually active? Are they more confident? Are they more sophisticated? Are they better informed about it all than we were? And we had a chance to look in this large-scale survey of 19,000 people in Britain at the sexual behaviour of people of all ages. This was the National Survey of Sexual Attitudes and Lifestyle. This was carried out in 1990 and 1991. It's a random sample, which means that everybody in Britain has an equal chance, theoretically, of being sampled. And that gives you the most representative sample. It makes sure that your results are going to be generalizable to the population as a whole, and not, as you often find in magazines and so on, when you get a survey in the pages of a magazine and you're invited to fill it in and send it back. The findings will not be representative of the whole population. They'll be representative of the readers of that magazine, and even more specifically, they'll be representative of those readers of that magazine who don't mind spending the time to fill in a questionnaire. So they're not really scientific in the sense that we'd like to think that this one was. We looked firstly at the age at which young people had sexual intercourse for the first time. And I've got a hunch that your ideas might differ from the facts as we found them. So I'm just going to test that hunch by asking you what you think the average age of first intercourse is. I'm just going to give you some choices. And as I give you an age, I want you to put your hand up if you think that that's the age at which most young people first have sex. So first of all, hands up, 15 or younger. Those of you who think, nothing to do with your own experience, those of you who think it's 15 or younger. I think we've got about a quarter to a third there. Put your hand up if you think it's 60. Eighteen or older. Right, so nobody thinks it's 18 or older for the average, and only about 4 people thought that it was 17, and the rest of you thought that the age at which most young people had sex was 16 or younger. When we look at the data, when we look at the data, we've looked here at the median number, that column. Down the left-hand side, you can see the ages of people in the sample, the ages of the respondents, the real ages when they were asked the question. The next column gives their ages, the median age, that's the age by which half of that group have had sexual intercourse. So that's rather like an average. For those of you who are familiar with medians, you'll know that we use medians often when we can't calculate the average because we don't know what the whole of that sample are doing. They haven't yet done what we're trying to measure. But as you can see, if you look at that age group 16 to 19 at the top of the column, you see that the median age for men is 17 and that the median age for women is also 17. Now that's dropped a great deal. If you look at the 55 to 59 year olds, on the bottom of that graph, of that table, you'll see that the median age there was 20 for men and 21 for women. So it's come down a lot, but it hasn't come down quite as much as you thought. And I think your responses on that, your punch that it was earlier on average than it seems to be, probably reflect the fact that we all think everybody else is doing things before we get around to doing them. And I think that's a pity, because when we asked another question to young people, did you think that was too early for you, or did you think it was around the right time, or did you think it was too late? Do you think you should have had first intercourse a bit earlier? And for those young people who had sex before 16, around half of the women and about a quarter of the men said that was too early for them. So there was quite a bit of regret around those very early starters. So next time you think that everybody else is having a very active and energetic sex life with you, just try to remember that table. Looking at it a bit differently, if we look at the under 16s, the proportion who are having sex for the first time under 16, again if you look at the top line of that's really where young people age 16 to 19 will find themselves, and you see that in the column marked women, roughly 1 in 5 young women in that age group have had sex before 16 for the first time, and roughly 1 in 4 men. So again, it's not the majority, but it is quite a sizable number of young people who are having sex at early ages. And if you look at that plotted over time, you'll see again that proportion has increased dramatically. The other thing that's really changed over time is, and this reflects our changing attitudes, I think, when we asked young people who their first partner was, fewer than 1% of young women said that their first sexual partner was the person to whom they were married. Whereas in the oldest age group of women, age 45 and over, 40% said that their first partner was their husband. So 40% of them had waited until marriage before they had sex for the first time. And that's a very major social change. Fewer than 1% today say they're married at the time of their first sexual intercourse. And we find this reflected in people's attitudes generally. This is a rather complicated bar graph, but if you look at what this shows is people's opinions on whether these different things are right or wrong. And what we've done here is put together the proportion of respondents who said that a particular behaviour was always or mostly wrong. And if you look at the top line, sex before marriage, you can see that only a very small proportion of men and women feel that to be wrong. And if you compare that with the next four, three lines, which are all about sex outside regular relationships, so we can broadly describe those as attitudes towards fidelity, you can see that people are much more disapproving of sex outside of a relationship than sex before marriage. So there's been a big change, a big increase in tolerance of that particular activity. Do young people today know enough? We assume that there's all this information buzzing around everywhere, that we have a very sophisticated generation of young people. But when we ask people, again, if they had enough information at the time of their first intercourse, which is after all when you need information about sexuality generally, the vast majority, as you'll see from that column on the left for men and again on the left for women, the vast majority said that they should have known more, and a much smaller proportion said that they knew enough. And if you look at the different shadings on that graph, the white box represents the 16 to 24 year olds. Now, if young people really had become so much better informed, you would expect that white band to be much taller, wouldn't you, than the others. And in fact, although the proportion who said they should have known more is slightly smaller in that white column, it's not a great deal smaller. So still, there's a great need for more information, accurate information, about sexuality generally. Of course, there are those who say that if we provide sex education in schools, then we're going to be pushing young people into early and experimental sexual relationships. And I've put together some cuttings from the newspapers here which show exactly that. You can see there even academics, professors slammed calamity of sex education, and Lady Cumberledge thinks it right to give condoms to girls, but shouldn't she be teaching her the art of saying no? You can see the kinds of newspaper coverage here. The child molesters, that's a little bit more emotive, suggesting that when sex educators get their hands on young people, then they're pushing them into all sorts of ways of behaving which are inappropriate. Well, one way of looking at this is to see whether in a particular population of people, those who receive sex education from school have sex earlier than those who receive it from other sources. So we looked at our information in that way. Again, these graphs are not easy to understand, but the columns here represent the proportion of the sample who had sex under 16. Now, as you can see, each of these refers to the way in which they gained their information about sexuality. And if you look at the column fourth from the left, boy and girlfriend, those who said that they received most of their information from their girlfriend or partner at the time, a much higher proportion, around a third of men and around a quarter of women had sex for the first time before the age of 16. But if you look at the column that represents those who got their information from school, which is on the far left, you'll see that a much smaller proportion of that group had sex for the first time before 16. So as far as our information tells us, it rather says exactly the opposite from the newspaper cutting that I showed you. Not that school sex education is pushing young people into early sex, but rather that if anything, it seems to be delaying that. So this sort of information is very useful for those who are trying to set up good programs of sex education in schools and in places in which young people are trying to find information which will be reliable. What are the big disadvantages of young people? Apart from the fact that they're not going to get on with their work, they're not going to pass their exams, they're not going to be getting on with what we think they should be getting on with, what other advantages are there to early sexual experience? Well, of course, one big disadvantage, one big outcome which we don't want is for early sexual experience to result in either sexually transmitted infection or pregnancy. And when we look at our information on young people, when we looked at the age at which young people first have sex, and then we looked at whether or not they used any contraception at that time, as you can see here, the earlier ages, 13, 14, 15, on both these graphs, the one on the left is for men and the one on the right is for women, at the early ages, the proportion who used no contraception was much greater than it was when sexual intercourse took place for the first time later. So, putting two and two together then, if the age at which young people have sexual intercourse for the first time is falling, and if younger people are not very good contraceptives, is it the case then that that young people today are less likely to use contraception than the previous generation? But when we look at that, we don't find any evidence for that. This graph shows the proportion of the population using no contraception at first interval. And that proportion, as you can see, far left for 16 to 19 year olds, it's a much smaller proportion of 16 to 19 year olds. It's still 1 in 5, which is putting quite a lot of young people at risk. But it's a smaller proportion than it was for the over 45s, for example, in fact the over 40s, where it was much more like 2 out of 5 people who were not using contraception at the time they first had sex. Of course, we have to remember that a proportion of those were already married, so they might not have been using contraception for the very good reason that they didn't want to prevent a pregnancy. But still, the evidence from that is that young people today are fairly efficient contraceptives. They're fairly good at preventing unwanted pregnancy. They're also, despite this collage, despite the information on here, they're also getting much better at protecting against sexually transmitted infection. This is a collage, not very clear, but this was it's quite old, that's why it's not very clear. It was around the time of the late 80s when a lot of information had been transmitted about the dangers of AIDS, the dangers of the AIDS epidemic, and the need to protect sex against not only pregnancy now, but sexually transmitted infections. And it was assumed then that really not much had changed, that people weren't taking any notice of the messages. And there were a lot of advertisements, a lot of public service announcements. You may have seen this at the cinema. Is this familiar to anybody? Well, this is Mrs. Dawson, and Mrs. Dawson works in the condom factory, and she's extremely happy because she's very busy. So on the advertisement at the cinema, Mrs. Dawson says that she thinks young people out there are doing very well. They're keeping her busy anyway, so they must be using a lot of condoms. And so this is really a sort of empowering message that actually quite a lot of protective behaviour is taking place. And this kind of advertisement, which you really wouldn't have seen 10 or 20 years ago, which is reminding people constantly of the need not only for protection against pregnancy, but also the protection against infection. And when we look at the data from our survey, this is the proportion using a condom at first intercourse by the year in which first intercourse occurred. And here I think I need this electronic device just to... If you look at the proportion of those using a condom at first intercourse, don't forget, it won't be exactly the same as the previous graph because they might be contracepting in other ways. But those using a condom was around 40% of the population having intercourse for the first time in each year until you get to around the mid-80s. And then it suddenly zooms up for both men and women to around 60 to 80%. Why might that be the case? What was so special about the mid-80s? You always bring it to each other, but what happened? That's right. The first case of AIDS in Britain was recorded in 1981, and gradually after that there was general public awareness and more government action to educate people about AIDS. And it does seem as if, from this information, that some of that has, some of that information has been converted into behaviour. So again, there's good evidence that not only that young people are becoming better at preventing pregnancy, but also that they're becoming better at protecting against infection. Finally, I just want to look, and this is a very complex graph, I'm going to help you through it. I asked earlier if one of the concerns of young people, one of the sources of panic, is that young people are becoming more promiscuous. And of course, if we think of that age at first intercourse falling, and the age at which marriage takes place rising, then you don't have to be a statistician to work out that you've got a lot more years in which to be having sexual relationships before you settle down. So even from the demographic information on the different times at which things happen, you would expect people to have larger numbers of partners where there was a longer period of time of being sexually active before settling down and having a family, if indeed that's what happens. And you can see from this table that in the 16 to 24 year age range, this is the numbers of sexual partners in different time periods. If you look at the lifetime numbers of partners, those in this age group have already had larger numbers of partners than those in this age group, even by the time they're 25. So certainly something is happening there which is resulting in all young people having more partners than the previous generation did. But when we look at the kinds of partnerships, and this is the last graph because I would like you, if you would like to ask some questions, you can see that the sociologists call this pattern of behaviour serial monogamy, when you have one partner after another rather than several at the same time. And you can see here that those who are monogamous are the majority, even of 16 to 24 year olds in the last 5 years, and those with concurrent partners, that's more than one partner at the same time, are a minority of both men and women. So yes, young people do seem to be having larger numbers of partners than the previous generation did, and there are obvious demographic reasons for that. But what doesn't seem to be happening is that they have those partners, that they have more than one sexual partner at the same time. So some of that panic can be quelled, I think, by looking at the scientific facts about behaviour. And of course, the other big advantage of doing a proper survey of sexual behaviour is the reassurance factor, that we don't feel very odd, we don't think that our own behaviour is out of line with everybody else's. So we've got a couple of minutes, and I very much welcome any questions that you might have. A bit daunting, asking questions about sex and teenage.
Don't want to all the others to hear in the audience, please feel free to ask her. She will be around for a